Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Viglund. You know, we like to think we're on the cutting edge here in the 21st century, but some of our biggest financial leaps forward happened back around 1933. Take it from this guy.
We also invented deposit insurance at that time.
That's economist Robert Shiller with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Robert says another financial invention got trotted out at about the same time as deposit insurance, one we sure could use more of today. So, history buffs, sharpen your pencils for a quiz. What invention was it? Could it be A, the long-term fixed-rate mortgage loan? Or are we talking about B, low-interest credit cards? Or was this jazz-age breakthrough called C, the savings account? Slept through your high school econ class, did you? Never fear. The answer's coming up on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. More and more homeowners are falling behind on their mortgages. They're losing their homes. Foreclosure filings were up 94% in October from the same month last year. A similar crisis hit in the 1930s. This week, we look at the government response then and now. I'm Tess Viglund. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
A course of treatment for the ailing housing market. A shot of adrenaline, stat. The federal government says average home prices in October dropped 3.5% from last year. The U.S. Conference of Mayors forecasts another 7% drop over the next year. What to do? Well, economist Robert Shiller wrote an op-ed in the New York Times recently calling for major new government initiatives to fix the housing situation. And he joins us now. Welcome back to the program.
Hi.
In your editorial in the Times, you compared today's housing market to that of a big decline that happened between 1925 and 1933, and all of the big reforms that that spurred. Remind us what some of those reforms were.
First of all, it used to be that people would get short mortgages, 3 years, 5 years, that would have you pay back the principal at the end. And people were losing their houses because they couldn't refinance. So what they did is they moved to the long-term fixed-rate mortgage. And this was done through government intervention, through the Homeowners Loan Corporation and the Federal Housing Administration, which were just set up in 1933 and 1934. And we also invented other things like deposit insurance at that time.
Back to the current situation, what are your suggestions?
I think that we need to do something about the kind of erosion of regulatory standards that has occurred in the mortgage industry. Since 1990 or so, we've seen the growth of subprime lenders who were not banks, and they're escaping from regulation. So I like the idea that Elizabeth Warren, who's a professor at Harvard Law School, has proposed that we should create a Financial Products Safety Commission modeled after the Consumer Product Safety Commission that would collect information about how people were being treated, how various financial products are really suitable or not for individuals, and whether some things are amiss.
You make a suggestion of a kind of price insurance that homeowners would be able to pay for. Can you explain what that would be?
Yes. What's happening right now is that home prices are falling, and they're falling rapidly in a number of places. And so they're in trouble. If they sell their house, they can't pay back their debts. This has brought on a wave of defaults. So this leads me to think that really mortgage contracts should have entailed some kind of protection against this kind of event. You might call it home equity insurance or a mortgage with down payment insurance. We could have offered these all along. We didn't. And so now there's all this talk about adjusting mortgages ex post. It'd be better if it was done from the beginning, that mortgage contracts should have had some flexibility built in.
What do you think it's going to take to get everybody to the table to talk about these issues?
Well, I think it could happen, and the thing that would make it happen would be a worsening of the crisis. I think there's a good chance that we're going to have a recession, and we'll see a lot of defaults on mortgages, and people are going to get angry and say, look, let's do something important about this problem.
Robert Shiller is a professor of economics and finance at Yale. He's also the co-founder and chief economist of Macro Markets LLC and also the author of Irrational Exuberance. Thanks so much for coming in.
It was a pleasure, Tess.
And we'll have more on the housing crisis and the federal response to it later in the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
Many investors are doing whatever they can to shelter their money from the subprime nightmare. Traditionally, money market funds were a big, snuggly security blanket. Americans have $3 trillion invested in these things, the most ever. But there's evidence the funds may be losing favor. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to look into it.
This is a tale of two investors, one in San Francisco, one in the Washington, D.C. area. They're on opposite coasts with opposite opinions on money market funds. Meet money manager Axel Merck. He's the guy in San Francisco. Recently, Merck took more than $100,000 of his personal savings out of money market funds. These funds take your cash and put it in highly rated and therefore supposedly safe investments, giving you a set interest rate. Problem is, some of them got entangled in the subprime mess. That's why Merck dumped his money market funds.
I'm not the type of person who says the world is going to go to an end and I put all my money into gold under a mattress. But at the same time, if there are hiccups in the financial world, why do you want to expose yourself to them?
Hey guys, are we ready for lunch?
Across the country, in Falls Church, Virginia, Vas Madhava works from home, supporting his wife and two kids as a full-time investor and budding day trader. He's got 30% of his money in money market funds, and it's staying put.
The money markets are like cash. They're the safe alternative to being in the market.
So, who's right? I decided to ask an expert, financial advisor David Murata.
Assuming that your money market is with a major broker, money market is probably one of the safest vehicles that you could have.
Oh, great, it's safe. Well, that's settled. What was that? You want to hear the first part of what Murata said again? Okay, rewind the tape.
Assuming that your money market is with a major broker.
Ah, there's the catch. You can't assume that all money market funds are safe. Remember, they're not insured by the FDIC. Now, banks do offer something called money market accounts. Just like savings accounts, they are protected by the FDIC, but they have a lower return. Now, back to money market funds. I know you like to root for the little guy, but in this case, Murata says you've got to put your money with one of the major brokerage houses. They can actually reach into their own pockets to make sure you don't lose anything. Murata says they'll make up any losses from money market funds that strayed into subprime territory. They're protecting their reputations.
If the broker that you're with has advertising on TV, they're spending more money for their advertising and their image than it would cost them to bail out their money market fund. So if you're not with a major broker, they may not deem it appropriate to bail out their money fund. They may find it's better just to fold up operations and go bankrupt.
But what if you really like your little mom-and-pop brokerage? Can't you just call them up and ask them if any of their money market funds are in subprime investments? You knew it wouldn't be that easy. Brokerages only have to list their money market fund investments in quarterly reports. Murata says any subprime risk is mixed in with other investments.
They've packaged it, and when they package it, it's harder to see the sausage under the skin.
Murata says some investors got tired of trying to decipher the fine print. At the height of the subprime scare this summer, a small number of investors did pull out of money market funds. But now they're back, according to Connie Bugby of iMoneyNet.com.
Since August 7th, which is when the subprime woes began or hit the airwaves and so forth, $353.87 billion has come into the money market funds.
There's almost $700 billion more in money market funds now than last year at this time. Bugbee's been following their ups and downs for years. In fact, she worked for the guy who created the funds back in the 70s. Right now, she says, some small investors are still skittish, but most would agree with our Virginia trader, Vas Madhava, that they won't lose any of the cash they put in money market funds.
Historically, it hasn't been an issue. Why should I worry about it now? If it starts to become an issue, then I'll worry about it at that time. But why bother?
But Axel Merck, our San Francisco investor, says if you have that attitude, it'll be too late by the time you start to worry. Everyone can agree, though, we'll know a lot more as the subprime mess shakes out. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
This week, we witnessed a stunning corporate about-face. Verizon announced it's opening up its network to any phone or software. That makes phone geeks very happy, but I'm not sure why. To find out, we turn to Marketplace's technology goddess, Lisa Napoli. Lisa, what does this mean for you and me? You know, people with cell phones.
Well, right away, it's not going to mean anything. But the hope and the promise is that down the road, you can buy any phone you want and use it on Verizon. Right now, as you know, you can't do that, right?
Right. You have to go buy a phone and then, you know, buy the contract with that one provider.
Exactly. And if there is a particular phone that you like because it's got some sexy feature, you can't just use it if you're a Verizon customer. But in a year, that's going to change. And the promise here is that since Verizon is opening the gates, everybody else will follow and open the gates. Not a guarantee, but that's the hope.
All right. Well, so that's great that you can take your phone with you no matter which company you're using for your service. But the thing that drives me nuts and that recently got me is the contracts, the 2-year contracts that you have to sign in order to get a free phone. Any chance that'll ever go away?
That's starting to go away because the reason they make you sign those contracts is because it costs them so much money to get you as a customer in the door, mm-hmm. they don't want to lose you. They can't afford to lose you, so they got to lock you in. And every time you've made a change, they lock you in
exactly.
even more, right? In the last 6 months, that started to go away a little bit because these cell phone companies realize that it's not just that they need to get you in the door. They need to get you in the door and you use more and more and more of their services because that's where they're making their money. They're not making the money from the phones. They're making the money from the collective power of all these people who sign up and stay with them. So the frustration that you've been feeling and this news with Verizon this week is a sign that things are starting to open up. It's still not great yet, but it's a sign of a sort of shift in the cell phone industry.
All right. In the meantime, at least, if you're a Verizon customer, you'll be able to bring your phone with you.
Exactly.
Marketplace's Lisa Napoli. Thanks.
Thank you.
Imagine getting an 8% return on your savings account. You can. In New Zealand. Chris tells us how to get in on the action and learn about a low-wage job with an eye-popping payoff.
The benefits I do receive here are just being around all the art all the time.
A day in the work life of a museum guard. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. A year ago, Norway's Edvard Munch Museum reported its version of The Scream was beyond repair. Thieves stole it in 2004. It was recovered, but water damaged. The museum has undergone a $6 million security upgrade, but one traditional element remains, the guards. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we get a tour from another museum's guard in Washington, D.C.
All right, well, down here, we're here in the mezzanine, and this particular section here is one of my favorites. We have a picture by Ellen Day Hale, which is of a lady sitting in a rocking chair like a country atmosphere. She's sewing, mending, but she's missing a button on her dress. And I always say that's how we women are. We take care of everybody else and everything else but ourselves. I'm Karen Harris. I'm a gallery guard here at the National Museum of Women in the Art. And I really love working here at the museum. I find it very fascinating. A guard here can make about $9 an hour. I don't receive any work benefits or work vacation, but the benefits I do receive here are just being around all the art all the time, the different exhibits, meeting different people. I've met Donna Carroll, I've met Della Reese, I've met Jane Curtin. I got to see Dougie Fresh, and I got to shake his hand and get a hug from him. And that's one of the times when I run home and say, guess who I saw, guess who I met? And it was like, yeah, right. Impressions that I get from other people when I tell them exactly what I do, for some it's like they'll say, well, I had to pay X amount of dollars to go to school in order to learn art history or do my art major, and you have it so well because you work here at the museum and you get to learn and observe. Some people get jealous, which I find kind of good in a way. I'm sorry that they have to pay all that money. I believe sometimes some people are just overly obsessed. There was this picture of Judith and Holofernes, and this lady was so intense. I mean, she wanted to get into the picture. I mean, she wanted to get real close. And I was like, excuse me, ma'am, you cannot get that close to the picture. And she was like, well, I'm not going to touch it. Well, you're close enough. And if you happen to trip or fall, you damn sure can't afford to pay for it. I've had several people ask me where was my gun and what would I do if someone came in here and tried to rob the museum. I don't have a gun. We have a guard downstairs, a security officer, ex-police officer, whatever you want to call him, that has a gun. And hopefully that will not get past him. The hardest thing about this job to me is the standing, the wear and tear on your feet and your knees and your back. Actually, when the museum is rather empty, I'll sit right where we're sitting and I stretch. In the beginning, I really wasn't into art. And one of the exhibits that really, really made me decide that I really liked art was Mae Stevens. She has different styles of painting. But this one exhibit we had, she was painting like in silver and gold. And she made it like the moon was glistening off the water. I remember standing in front of that particular painting. I can tell you exactly where it was in this museum, actually. I can still tell you where it was. That was just, I mean, I was just blown away. I was flabbergasted. I was in awe. It was just such a beautiful painting. I loved it. Then I knew.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
Ignored investors bring us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword. Proxy access. Proxy access is all about investors looking for respect. At shareholder meetings, they're allowed to vote on board members and company proposals, but they can't nominate members or make their own proposals. Activists hope to change that and give some stockholders a chance to have more say. Well, this week the SEC thought about it and decided to keep things as is. So now the only tools investors have to get themselves heard are phone calls, emails, and maybe a rock through the SEC window.
Got a box full of letters. Think you might like to read.
A
Okay, judging by the music, it is mailbag time. That's when we find out what financial questions you, dear listener, have burning in your brain. And with me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
How you doing, Des?
Good. Are you done with your leftover turkey yet?
I was disappointed. I don't have any leftover turkey.
No.
I went to my sister's. We had a wonderful Thanksgiving. But when you go to somebody else's place,
the leftovers stay there.
Exactly.
All right. Let's go ahead and get to the questions, shall we?
Okay.
But before we do, take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there. Or if you like, you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that M-O-N-Y. And our first caller is Holly from Music City. That, of course, is Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to the show, Holly.
Hi.
So are you a singer?
No, I'm not.
You're not. Well, what do you do there in Nashville?
I'm a graphic design student at Watkins College of Art and Design.
Oh, and what year are you?
I'm a junior.
And what do you want to do with that degree?
I'd like to pursue graphic design in Chicago.
Chicago, mm-hmm. The Windy City.
Yep.
Go from Music City to the Windy City.
Right.
All right. Well, what's your question for Chris today?
I wanted to ask about the cost of living in Chicago and the salary pay for an entry-level graphic designer.
Suffice it to say, Chris, I'm going to guess that Chicago is a little more expensive than Nashville.
It's a wonderful city, but yes, it is a little more expensive. So, Holly, there are two things that you can do online. First of all, if you go to money.com and you click on their real estate section, you'll come to what's called a cost of living calculator. And National Association of Realtors also has one. And what you do is you plug in a salary, let's say $30,000 a year. And then you say, well, okay, what do I need to earn in Chicago to have the same standard of living that I do in Nashville? The other is to go to some websites like salary.com and take a look at what sort of salary you could expect in Nashville versus what kind of salary you could expect in a place like Chicago.
Chris, will that other website, money.com, will that give her some idea, for example, of how much rent might be in Chicago versus Nashville and even food prices and that sort of thing?
It'll tell you is the rent in Chicago is, say, 50% higher than the rent, comparable rent that you'd be paying in Nashville. So it'll give you a percentage. So if you're paying $500, $600, $700 a month in Nashville to get a comparable place in Chicago, you'd be spending 50% more.
Holly, have you been to Chicago? Have you done a little research yourself?
Yes, we have a couple friends up there, and we visit there pretty much twice a year.
Yeah. Well, are you going anytime soon?
Yes, I'm going after Christmas.
Oh, well, that would be a great time for you to even just go to the grocery store and see how much a carton of milk is there versus Nashville. You know, take a look at the gas stations. Look up in the Tribune or the Sun-Times. Take a look at what the rents are.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'd walk around with someone and take a look at some apartments and have it shown to you. And, you know, maybe try and look in a couple of places with a broker and, you know, have them show you some places. What it would cost you, what the neighborhood is like, is this where you'd like to live? And then also, obviously, you know, try and make some sort of evaluation about prospects for not only your entry-level salary, but prospects for promotion, prospects for other job opportunities while you're in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So, Holly, when are you thinking about doing this move, right after graduation?
Yes.
So you have another good year and a half to figure this out.
Yes, I do.
Thanks for the call, Holly, and good luck.
You too.
All right, let's reach into the email bag, Chris. And Rebecca writes in from Minneapolis, Minnesota. You're familiar with that city, are you not?
I think I know a little bit about the town, yes.
Well, her credit card recently changed its terms. This never happens, does it?
No, never. Yeah. Have you ever read the fine print? It sort of basically says, we can change the terms whenever we want, and whatever you've agreed to doesn't matter. But okay, go ahead.
Lovely. Well, anyway, they're changing the terms to charge her interest. She never carries a balance between billing statements, but now she gets charged this interest based on the average daily balance, which we've all seen if we've looked at our credit card statements. It used to be calculated on a monthly basis. So her question is, are there very many credit card companies changing terms in this way to make more money? I wonder what your answer is going to be. And more to the point, do you have any advice for selecting a new card that maybe won't charge her if she pays in full every month?
Right. Now, the most common method of charging is the average daily balance, which, no surprise here, is the method most in favor of the credit card company.
Sure.
And not you. The other thing where the consumer is really getting hit, and I actually wonder whether this is also happening to Rebecca, there's this thing called the grace period. Grace period used to be equivalent to the month, 30, 31 days. And, you know, as long as you paid your bill off the grace period, there was no charges. Well, on average, I believe the grace period has now shrunk to about 20 to 22 days.
That's not very much grace.
Ah. And therefore, you get caught a lot more. People who always pay it off monthly, well, it turns out they have some interest charges because of the change in the terms of the grace period. So you could go to a website like cardweb.com or bankrate.com and do a little research. And what you really want to do is find a card that has a 30, 31 day grace period. That's extremely important. More than likely, most of the cards you look at will be average daily balance, but you get that good grace period. That's a nice thing. And that makes it more favorable for those people who pay off their credit cards, which is all the Marketplace Money listeners. I know that's in your favor, and that's what you want.
All right. Well, a good rule of thumb is to never sign anything before you read it. But what if you still can't understand it after you do that? Well, then it's time to let us help. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, caller number two is on the line. Michael is with us from Vienna, Virginia. Hi, Michael.
Hi there.
What do you do there in Vienna, Virginia?
Well, I'm a defense contractor for Northrop Grumman. I actually work down in Quantico, so I have a bit of a drive.
You work in Quantico, huh?
Unfortunately, it's not as sexy as it sounds, but I'm a bit of a glorified bureaucrat, I think.
Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm living in a condo with my now fiance. I purchased the condo about a year ago. She and I are looking to pick up a single-family home and take advantage of the recent dip in both interest rates and home prices. Do you all think it makes sense for me to sacrifice as much as $30,000 or $40,000 off of the price I paid on the condo in order to pick up a potential drop in the single-family home market, which at a glance looks like it could be $75,000 to $100,000? And, of course, you do the quick math, and I think the answer would be yes, but maybe there are some unforeseen pitfalls. I don't know. I've never met anyone who's really sold a home at a loss before, and I don't know how much risk is involved with, you know, obviously selling first and then picking up a home afterward.
Well, first of all, do you have any equity?
Yes, I've managed to. I put down $30,000 on the condo when I bought it, and I paid off about $7,500 additionally since then. So.
But you're saying you would still be selling at an actual loss, so you would be $30,000, $40,000 in debt to the bank?
I'm not sure. I think the asking prices in the market right now are right about what my mortgage stands at right now, about $260,000, give or take $5,000. So in terms of going into the red or owing money on the mortgage, I don't think I would be in bad shape, but I would still have a capital loss, I think, of about $30,000 or $40,000.
Okay. Well, Chris, this is certainly a question that a lot of people are dealing with falling home prices all over the country. So is it wise to go ahead and take a loss on the condo and then get into the housing market with a single-family home, you know, while the market is in such bad shape? You might be able to get a deal.
I'm still a little bit confused because the term taking a loss on the condo, in other words, you're not making any profit, but you're essentially breaking even on the mortgage. So you can sell it, pay off the mortgage, and walk away.
That's correct.
That's one thing. That may not be such a, you know, at that point, I would say, well, why not put it up for sale and see if you can really do that? The more that you owe the bank with the sale because you don't get enough for the sales price, then at that point I say, boy, you know, I don't know if that's really the best financial move that you could be making. Yes, prices are down, interest rates are low, but you're starting out in a marriage and a lot of other things going on in your life. You know, the more you would be writing that check to the bank, the less the deal makes sense to me.
Okay.
What I would do is explore the market. I'd put it up for sale, work with a realtor, and, you know, if you're not getting an acceptable price, you can always say to the realtor, well, you know, you work, but that's the nature of your business. You don't get anything, and I'm going to take it off the market and wait a little while till things firm up a little better.
Michael, are you in a position at this point to finance a single-family home?
Yes. when you combine my fiance's income with mine, we more than qualify for what we're looking at.
All right. Well, best of luck and early congratulations.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate your help with this.
Terrific. Thanks so much for the call.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Are you financially stuck and want to move up? Well, before you make any decisions, we do want you to give us a call and we'll do our best to help out. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY or visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, Chris, one more reach into the email bag. And Lawrence writes in from Lanesboro, Massachusetts. His daughter lives in New Zealand and tells him that the banks there are paying 8 to 9% on savings accounts. Seems like a great deal to him, so he wants to take advantage of it, but has some reservations. Wants to know, essentially, how can he go about investing his money in New Zealand? Are there any hidden costs, risks that he should be thinking about? Is this a good idea to send his money overseas where his daughter is?
Well, I have to tell you, Tess, I had that thought about moving there after watching religiously the 3 episodes of Lord of the Rings. But there is a high interest rate on the bank accounts. There's a lot of hot money that has flowed to New Zealand. And the reason is that the central bank there is concerned about a real estate bubble and overall concerned about higher inflation. So they have this high rate. How do you take advantage of it? Well, you could go to, we've mentioned before, EverBank in St. Louis. It has CDs denominated in New Zealand dollars. And the risk there, the dollar could appreciate. It could appreciate, in which case you may not
really?
Make much money. The dollar could go lower, in which case you're going to make some nice money. And these are foreign denominated certificates of deposit. You buy it for a certain length of time. You're exposed to the New Zealand dollar at that point, and then you have to just worry about what happens to the U.S. dollar.
What if Lawrence sent a check to his daughter and had her actually invest the money for him in a bank there?
There's no reason why they couldn't do that.
But you're still going to have transaction fees, probably?
You're still going to have transaction fees, transaction costs. The other thing, though, is perhaps what you could do is do exactly what you're suggesting and then take a trip to New Zealand.
Ah, there you go.
And then use some of that money to pay for it.
And then I assume that New Zealand has online banks like we do, like ING Direct. Could he actually find a New Zealand bank online and simply do direct deposit with them?
In today's world, I would assume yes. I don't know for sure. Remember, the United States is the second largest trading partner for New Zealand. So there's a lot of exchange that goes on between the two economies, even though we're pretty far apart from each other. And so I would not be surprised at all.
Well, there you go, Lawrence. Best of luck with that. And unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. Do leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y, or visit our contact page on our website. We're at marketplace.org. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks, Tess.
Coming up, we're house hunting in Oregon, MTV style.
It's the true story of what it's like to be in a buyer's market and what it's like to be in a seller's in that fast a time.
And another visit with our Seattle Investment Club. They might have found the ticket to stock market profits.
I think that's the company with the most opportunity for growth. They do one thing, they do it really well. They have other assets that they're not selling, for example, information.
Which company? Stay tuned. It's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. It's time for a final 2007 update in our Investment Club series. All year, we've been following 3 clubs, one in Seattle, another in San Jose, and a third in Fairfax, Virginia, as they figure out what stocks to buy, sell, and hold throughout the year.
The stock didn't do very well.
What sectors do you buy?
Prices are going to continue to go up.
Join the club.
Our last visit to Seattle was back at the end of July, just as the credit crunch and mortgage mess were taking a serious toll on Wall Street. This time around was no better, as club members Nathan Bugia and Sandy Fadke digested the day's rumors of potential bankruptcy at the online brokerage E-Trade.
I remember 3 years ago when we looked at E-Trade, it was getting most of its money from mortgages, not from brokerage income. Well, that was really surprising. Well, now I guess it's the other shoe dropping.
The CEO said they can't account for how much debt they have.
Yeah.
They just,
it's the subprime mortgage.
Also around the table, Mohit Srivastav, Sumit Lohia, and Chen Lim. They're all members of the Meridian Pacific Investment Club that meets once a week at the Vivace Coffee House in Seattle. The big assignment for this gathering was to review the pros and cons of a recently announced corporate breakup, Barry Diller's IAC Interactive Corporation, or IACI. It's currently a mishmash of retailers, advertising, and internet companies. Chen Lim took charge of researching the split.
Quick recap, so IACI is spinning off into five component companies. So what I did is I took a look at the past couple of years of 10-Ks, the annual reports, and I also looked at the latest 10-Q. And I also listened in on the conference call where they announced the split, you know, to get any kind of tidbits of information. So here's kind of the output from what I've, you know, kind of gathered from all that.
And with that, Lim started his computer presentation for the group, complete with charts and graphs of IACI's performance and its component companies, including Ask.com, the Home Shopping Network, and Ticketmaster, among others. Bhujia thought of all the properties, Ticketmaster might ultimately be a good stock to purchase after the split.
I think that's the company with the most opportunity for growth. They do one thing, they do it really well, and I feel like they have other assets that they're not selling. For example, information. They don't syndicate their list of events anywhere to any of the major search engines, for example.
I wonder how much disclosure they'll give about kind of the vision and leadership of Ticketmaster before the split happens.
I assume they will. I don't know what the next point is, but so they definitely need to announce what the actual split will be. So I assume they'll have to, you know, provide financial statements for all five companies.
So this is something that essentially you'll watch over the next few months. But it sounds like if you were to invest in something, you're kind of leaning toward Ticketmaster after the split.
Probably Ticketmaster based on the valuation. We'll take a look.
Ticketmaster, I think, also because it's easy to understand.
But none of that happens until next year. So for this year, I wanted to know how they'd done on their investments. Remember, this club is a little different from the ones in San Jose and Virginia. They don't invest as a group. First up, Nate.
I've had probably about an 8% return. It's been a very boom and bust kind of year. We made a couple good investments that netted quick, big money. Those Google and Microsoft. But aside from those, it's just been sitting, waiting for opportunities, and not really investing much at all.
How about you, Sandy?
I'd say my 401k is about 12%. My brokerage account is doing a little bit better because I'm disproportionately exposed to Microsoft. We just happen to have a pretty good quarter. So because of that, I'm up 17%.
And Mohit?
Yeah, I've been up as high as 20%, and I've lost like 8% in the last 2 weeks. But my strategy the past year has pretty much been to bet against the dollar.
Submit? You know, some of the amount is sitting in money market just because it's just parked there waiting to see, you know, how this all turns out. In a different light, you know, I'm at a time where I wanted to start looking at actually buying real estate within Seattle. The market is really good. So it makes for a good investment opportunity sometime, anytime over the next, you know, 3 to 4 months for sure.
And Jen, I actually haven't seen you since January, so how have your investments done the year?
So looking back over the last year, I think what I did personally was I was actually spooked earlier in the year. So I had taken most of my money actually out into cash, and what I was doing was sitting on the sidelines waiting for the crash, which didn't really happen early this year. And of course, it was this kind of mid-year rally, right, you know, in tech particularly. So I actually caught some of that. So I think I cherry-picked a couple of stocks. I remember I got into Google at, you know, something like I rolled it from 520 to up to 600.
As they wrap up the year, these guys, like many investors, are aware of the potential for recession. I asked Nate what his reaction is when he hears the R word.
I curl up and I cry. I mean, there's the standard stuff that you're supposed to do, like utilities and commodities and stuff like that. So I've done a little bit of that. And not a whole lot more.
And Mohit Srivastav says he's responding by thinking globally.
There is opportunity to make money outside the U.S., even if the U.S. economy is in recession, more so than there was in the past.
I want to thank all you guys for letting me sit in over the last year. Good luck next year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All I want to hear is in your last report, all the clubs did well, but the Seattle Club beat all of them.
We'll see. Tune in next week to find out how the women of formerly Baroque in Virginia have done this year. By the way, these were our final meetings with these clubs. We're looking for new ones to follow in 2008. If you're willing to let us sit in on your meetings every so often, send us a note about your own investment club. Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. You can also find the entire year-long series on our website.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
So we heard earlier in the show that home prices are dropping all over the place. Well, a lot of buyers are trying to figure out when the bottom will hit. Ethan Lindsay is one of them. He's a reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting in Bend, Oregon. That city tripled its population over the last 15 years. Home prices rose in tandem. Ethan sent us this story about jumping on the roller coaster that is the real estate market.
At one time, Bend was home to the world's second largest lumber operation. But in the early 80s, new environmental rules and cheaper Canadian wood killed the town's economy. That is, until early retirees and ski bums discovered the city and turned it into a resort town. Locals now call it the Vale of the Northwest. In 1992, the Brooks Scanlon Mill cut its final piece of wood. Today, the old mill building is home to an REI, a Victoria's Secret, and a Gap store.
These we just got, which I think are adorable.
The housing market in town has moved upscale, too. Back when lumberjack flannel was fashionable, median home prices were under $100,000. Last month, I went on a home tour with local real estate agent Becky Breeze. She told me the average home today sells for $350,000.
So what do these start at then?
These start at $599,900, okay. And depending on what you're looking at, what floor you're on.
Breeze has sold homes in Bend for more than two decades. And in that time, more and more baby boomers from California have discovered Bend. But the tipping point came 2 years ago. Home prices in Bend jumped by more than 30% between the years 2005 and 2006. That was the biggest leap in the entire country. Kent Chappell owns a coffee shop in town and a home as well. He says homebuyers here read their property prices like the stock pages.
I do pay attention to it, but I knew that it was overvalued, and all my neighbors were all excited about how our houses had increased in value and all that. But it was kind of funny to me because where are you going to move to, right? Everything's increased. So if my house is worth more, but I can't afford to buy a new house, then what difference does it make? You know?
I do know, sort of. I've been looking to buy my first house since July, and I expected home prices to be very affordable in a smaller town. Instead, they're on par with big cities like Portland or Seattle.
The homes are gorgeous.
Realtor Becky Breeze doesn't have a bad word to say about Bend. To her, home prices mean the market is bright. But even she sees some dark clouds on the horizon.
The only problem is so many agents went into the business, and there's so many mortgage brokers went into the business during that little upside period, that there's not enough to support that many people.
Breeze says Bend's home prices have bucked the national trend and stayed stable so far.
We wish some of our houses would sell a little faster. Absolutely.
In fact, home prices are expected to be 25% lower this year than the boom year of 2005. And like the rest of the country, that's pushed the number of unsold homes on the market to record levels. More supply with less demand is what economists would call a buyer's market. And that's good for me. I've seen desperation in some home sellers' eyes. At several open houses, the seller started to haggle with me the moment I walked in the door. In the past few months, I've walked through 30 or so homes in my price range. Of those, fewer than five have sold. Dawn Dwyer is a realtor in town. I chose her as my agent because she works with first-time home buyers.
Definitely in full swing of buyer's market.
Dwyer says that in 2005, many of the homes I've looked at would have been swamped with multiple offers on the day they were listed. And furious bidding wars broke out over these homes. My experience has been the opposite.
To our advantage, it's nice to compare it to maybe some stuff on the west side.
In my hunt, I fell in love with a two-bedroom bungalow with a nice breakfast nook and a great front yard. When I first saw the house, it had been on the market for more than a month. I finally got it for $20,000 less than the price on the sign out front.
I mean, it's the true story of what it's like to be in a buyer's market and what it's like to be in a seller's in that fast a time, in a few years, to see that much of a difference. It's amazing, but yeah, you're really lucky.
So the housing slowdown does have some positives, at least for buyers like me. But as a whole, the city probably isn't so happy. Real estate is the third largest employer in Bend. It pays the salaries of 15% of working residents. That scares some economists who say if the housing market goes, so could the local economy. That scares me too. Maybe this isn't the time to be buying that first home. In Bend, Oregon, I'm Ethan Lindsay for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
it's like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, we've already talked about this earlier in the show. Home prices are down, sales are down, and it's just a month until 2008 when apparently more than $350 billion worth of subprime adjustable mortgages are going to reset to a higher interest rate. Not good news.
No, it's not good news. And you know, a lot of those homeowners, they can't afford the new bill.
Right.
I mean, there's a real risk test that what we'll see in 2008 is this vicious downward spiral of defaults, leads to falling prices, leads to more defaults.
But, you know, we heard this week that Washington may finally step in to avert the crisis. You want to talk about this?
Well, you know, Tess, until now, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson has been playing his version of waiting for Godot. I know that sounds harsh, but it's the right image.
Okay.
But now, finally, it looks like he's going to follow the lead of California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and the advice of the FDIC, mm-hmm. the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and try to freeze subprime rates before they reset. Here's the straight story. This is good news, and it should happen. Secretary Paulson, freeze rates now.
All right. Well, how does that work? You just make an announcement that everybody's adjustable rate is now fixed?
Well, let's look what Governor Schwarzenegger did. He got four of the big lenders in California where 500,000 homes, half a million homes are at risk. Countrywide, GMAC, Litton, HOMEC. And, you know, he said, let's strike a deal. Now, what he struck a deal with is a temporary freeze. And one of the things by getting the four big lenders, which account for, I think, about a quarter of the market. One of the things about getting the four big lenders there is they're all on the same page. They don't have to worry about a competitor undercutting them or doing something that's going to cause them competitive damage. So it was not a bad deal. It helps out California. Why can't we do it nationwide? And by the way, Schwarzenegger says he got the idea from the FDIC.
Well, what do we mean by temporary? I mean, how much relief does that really give homeowners?
Well, it's a little bit squishy, but the head of Litton, you know, so temporary could be 5 years. Would you get to a new housing market? You get some equity restored. Hopefully some of these homeowners would be able to refinance their mortgages, which they can't right now with falling prices, but if prices go back up.
And the credit crunch, of course. No bank is wanting to lend money right now.
Absolutely. So here's what I like about the idea. Maybe there's a better idea out there. This is the one that I think is particularly good. These homeowners that are subject to the deal, you know, they're current on their payments. They're paying somewhere between 6-8% on their mortgages right now, and they're making those payments. So if you freeze the rate at 6-8%, that's a fairly decent interest rate in today's environment. It's not like they're getting a free ride. The banks, they take a hit, but they've got the balance sheets that can take the hit, and everybody comes out ahead, including the economy.
But there are those who would argue that this is tantamount to a free lunch. I mean, everybody's been warning about this housing slump for at least a couple of years.
Right.
Shouldn't people have already gotten out of their bad mortgages and refinanced?
And I have really two responses to that. One is the ad hoc negotiations that are going on right now. Let's say you were a subprime borrower with an adjustable rate mortgage and you're trying to renegotiate with Countrywide or GMAC. In general, these sort of ad hoc negotiations are not going well and they aren't dealing with the problem. The second thing is we are dealing with an issue that will hit the overall economy. It was $350 billion plus dollars we're talking about. And again, I'd make the point, a lot of the defaults and foreclosures that we've had up till now have to do with just, I think, what you're talking about, a lot of speculators. Then there are the people who they were sold bad deals that they did not understand.
Uh-huh.
We're now facing a very different situation. These are homeowners current on 6-8% adjustable rate mortgages that are going to go into default or the risk of default. That's what I think we need to deal with. I don't think it's a free lunch. And frankly, when you're dealing with a broad-based economic issue, some people always get bailed out. But the majority of people, I think, are honest homeowners who tried an honest deal that are really on the financial edge.
All right. The Straight Story from our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
And finally, Chris just talked about how freezing interest rates would help consumers. But a lot of folks seem to be just as worried about the dollar as they are about the mortgage crisis. The greenback has been losing ground all year against other currencies, even the Canadian loonie. But is the dollar's fall as bad as it sounds? Catherine Mann, a professor of economics at Brandeis, says the biggest risk is inflation. All that stuff we import gets more and more expensive.
The worst case scenario is that foreign producers really have to send through that cost increase, and that will show up on the retail shelf. At the same time, we get a backdoor effect because our exports are going to be going abroad, and so prices of those products are going to rise here as well. So there would be two reasons for why you'd have higher inflation in the U.S.
But on the other hand, our goods become cheaper, so more foreigners snap them up, generating sales for the economy. Mann says for the average consumer, the dollar's fall may be kind of embarrassing, but so far it's not having a direct effect on our wallets.
The issues in the subprime market, the financial system volatility, those are really the worry. The falling dollar is not one of the biggest worries facing U.S. consumers these days.
Unless, of course, you're traveling to Europe or Canada for the holidays. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, how does our Virginia Investment Club do it?
At our August meeting, we were down 10%. At our September meeting, we were up 7%. Our October meeting, we were up 14%.
Wait till you hear how they did in November. Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.